So I've said that supervaluationism has these four putatively attractive features. Minimally, it does what we really want to do in this area, which is to assign some kind of blame. It's reasonably intuitive. It provides a precise treatment of vague expressions. So in particular, right, there are certain kinds of approaches to vagueness that, so to speak, appeal to vagueness in their theoretical machinery. Right? So they recapitulate whatever vagueness is our target when we're theorising in our object language, say English, in the theoretical machinery that they use to characterise what's going on in that language. And that might be okay, and that might ultimately be required, but one of the nice features of supervaluationism is that it kind of gives an account of what's going on at the vague level in terms of concepts that seem more precise, at least modulo the issue raised just before the break. And to some people, the fact that it retains classical logical principles is a bonus. It doesn't respect the entirety of classical logic because it gives up bivalence. We might reasonably think that bivalence is a component of classical logic, but it does a good job of containing the rot that rejection of bits of classical semantics sometimes leads into. And one point there is you might yourselves not care so much about retaining classical logic. You might think that there are other reasons, say, for wanting to give up bits of classical logic. And you might be right. But it'll turn out that at a certain level, this idea also figures in motivating the other kind of view that we'll be looking at. Right? The idea, the epistemicist idea, is motivated to a large extent by precisely the idea that it pays maximal respect to classical logic. Right. Why? Well, it leaves everything in reality and in semantics as it is with respect to classical logic and puts the entire blame for any difficulties we get into in this area on us and our knowledge acquiring capacities. Yeah.
There's something I don't quite get about the whole issue of keeping bivalence while, of getting rid of bivalence while keeping the law of excluding middle. It seems in some way like it has it both ways. So when you're dealing with the bivalence question, it says basically, that this is neither true nor false because we're identifying truth with super truth and falsity with super falsity. Mm-hmm. But then you go to the law of the excluded middle and there you're no longer really doing it. You're saying that it's either super true or it's not super true. It seems to me that these are two different...
No, you're saying that it's... You're saying that it's super true, so true. So remember that the supervaluationist identifies the ordinary notion of truth for any expression of fact with super truth.
Yes. But when you put in something like, I mean, if you have a, let's say we have a borderline case that 150 grains of sand is in the same space. And then in the particular instance of the law excluded middle here, it's 150 grains of sand is a 150 grains of sand is a heap, or 150 grains of sand is not a heap. Mm-hmm. That's true for every admissible sharpening. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
it's going to look fishy, right? I mean, if you're committed to both bivalence and the law of excluded middle, and you're so committed in part because you see these as forming a kind of organic whole, then you're going to find it very puzzling to pull them apart.
Yeah.
We'll see some specific arguments in that direction in a minute.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things you're getting at is that what happens here is that we start with a puzzle that arises we've got this claim, this is a heap. At some point that goes from being true, say, to being neither true nor false. But all the way along the line, we get, look, either this is a heap or it's not a heap. And that can seem puzzling. So you say, look, is this a heap? Yeah. It's neither true nor false.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it either a heap or not a heap? Yeah.
Can we just define the heap in a way that it's not indeterminate? So, for example, if I check the different definition, it says a group of things placed, thrown, or lying one on another. So it means one on another, so on top. So according to this definition, like two things can be a heap.
could, but then we'd have to argue about whether that definition is accurate.
Yeah, right. If we apply this definition, then there will be no question about whether it's true or false.
There might be, but then we'd have minimally, right? If we accept all that, we have an absolutely local solution. So suppose it's so of heap. Suppose that people weren't aware of this when they first used heap to generate these kinds of examples, but it turns out there's an absolutely sharp answer. Things have to be stacked one on top of the other, so I guess minimally we get Tommy's solution, and if you've got two, you can have a heap. The problem will be to generalise that to all the other cases. So suppose we save heaps, what about bald people?
Yeah.
So now we look up a definition of baldness.
I think also a really good example, which I personally prefer, is, for example, the question, is it dormant here?
Mm-hmm.
Because conceivably, I don't know the physics of it enough, but conceivably this might be a whole continuum. And so it seems, because the steps can get as small as you like.
But that's going to be so in all these cases. I mean, even with respect, say take that definition. I mean, one thing we're doing in presenting these cases is, for example, assuming that granularity, or being a grain, is non-vague, and that looks like a mistake. So now suppose we define a heap in terms of grains being so arranged. There'll be two further sources of vagueness at that point, one of which will be, when do you have a grain as opposed to something that's less than a grain? And the other will be, when do you have something that's really on the other thing, rather than...
Well, then we have to check the definition of the grain.
But now suppose that we discover on the internet some definition of grain that none of us is willing to accept, and that figures in no way in our own usage of grain. There'll now be a question whether that definition's accurate.
But do we have an alternative?
We don't, in general, we don't have definitions for the expressions we use. And we couldn't, in absolute generality, because in order to have any definitions, you have to have the elements that form the definition. So one would get in a kind of circle at some point if one required that everything had to be defined. So what happens in a dictionary is that you kind of bottom out, you look up some words, they're defined in terms of some other words, so you look those other words up, and at some point, you get pointed back to...
How do we say that something is true or false if we don't have a definition?
Because we have a way of knowing how to apply an expression that doesn't go via some explicit definition. So again, think about the elements that would make up such a definition. At some point, we're going to get to cases that aren't themselves defined in a non-circular way. So either we understand them in some way that doesn't go via further definition, in which case we can use them to define the other expression, or we don't understand them at all, in which case, again, we can't use them to give a definition. So at some point you're going to bottom out in a basic capacity to use some expression or judge in a certain way where that doesn't articulate into some specific analysis, some kind of way of defining that expression. You might be able to theorise about it in certain ways, but that's not to say there's going to be a fixed, absolutely sharp definition. Where you do have one, and where it's not susceptible to these issues of vagueness, then you have that. So I think the best way of pursuing that idea isn't to suppose that in all these cases there is some definition associated with the expression which fixes an absolutely sharp boundary. Right? Whether or not there is a sharp boundary, it's not that that's fixed by some definition. But one might nonetheless propose that this would be a version of the accepting the conclusion. We might propose that all ordinary expressions susceptible to this argument are to that extent broken, and we need to replace them with sharply defined notions that are suitable for certain specific purposes. I mean, I'd suggest that that notion of a heap actually works like that. I don't think that captures anyone's ordinary understanding of what a heap is, but it might well serve certain purposes in structural engineering or what have you, where it might be a technical notion that's related in certain ways, a bit like a sharpening of our ordinary concept. But I think these are good questions and good things to worry about. But one thought would be, perhaps we can replace all our messy, messed up, vague concepts with absolutely sharp concepts and do everything we need to do in that way. That would be the kind of Taskian approach to problems in this area. The difficulty will be that for example, and this came up, I think, in the seminars, that some of these sharply defined notions will be impossible to use, right? So, or at least very, very difficult, unwieldy to use. So suppose there were a definition of heap for certain technical purposes that involved some very specific number of grains in some very specific arrangement. Now, you know, if I just want a bunch of sand for some purpose, I can't use, I won't want to use this notion to get you to go get it for me. You know, go and get me a heap Z, one of these weird things. Jesus, you could spend weeks checking the fine detail of the things you're presented with. That would be hopeless. Whoever say, go and get me a heap, go, yeah, that'll do. Right? It's just, it's enough like a heap. But it's those cases where it's useful for us to have these kinds of margin for errors or seem margins for error around our concepts in order that we can easily and swiftly apply them. Right? Say, that's definitely red, you know, that's red, that's a heap, that's a human, and so forth, without having to worry about this number n, such that, yeah.
I mean, I think the solution, if you're asked to do that, is probably to go and get something that's definitely
a heap,
right?
Yeah. But that, as we'll see, that will assume that the definite heap, and as was mentioned for the great. So there might be responses of this kind, and you might absolutely be right that there are specific cases where this problem goes away because we have some specific definition. The worry in general, though, will be even where one has such a definition, the terms doing the defining will themselves be susceptible to versions of the argument. So we'll get a kind of projection. So grain, how big does something have to be a grain, and so forth. Okay, so problems for supervaluationism. So, we've said that the middle premise, I mean, the way that supervaluationism deals with the paradox is by saying that the middle premise of the sorites argument, the tolerance principle, comes out as neither true nor false. And there's no instance of the following existential generalisation that comes out true, so super true, true on all sharpenings. For some number n, a pile of n grains is not a heap, while a pile of m plus one grains is a heap. Right? So there's no number, there's no specific number where this thing comes out super true. Right? That's the kind of result we want. So we haven't moved from denial of the tolerance principle to assertion of a specific sharp cutoff point. Well, okay. There are no specific cases of that generalisation that come out true, but in fact, the generalisation itself does come out true for the same kinds of reasons that the law of excluded middle comes out true on this account. So, the generalisation is going to be true on every sharpening because every sharpening will sustain some number n, such that adding one to that number will take you from a falsehood to a truth, or a truth to a falsehood. Okay, so the generalisation, I've got that completely wrong, the generalisation itself will come out true, even though there's no instance of the generalisation that comes out true. Okay, so any particular claim you make of this kind, a heap is something that's n or more grains of sand, will come out false. So that's kind of weird. It's weird in the way that the mismatch between bivalence and the law of excluded middle is weird. And moreover, one kind of basic intuition some people have and that drives certain kinds of semantic approaches to the sororities is that that existential generalisation should come out false. Right? The assertion that there's a specific cutoff point should come out false. Okay. I mean, the oddity is that although this view asserts that there is a sharp cutoff point, it in effect doesn't assert of any particular number that it's the sharp cutoff point. So if that's the thing that you don't want to assert, that there's some number n, it preserves that. But some people think that their intuition is slightly more general than that, that there is, that this generalisation should come out false. Okay. So that intuition might be wrong, and it might be a misreading of the genuine intuition, which concerns the specific cases. But even if it is wrong, it looks as though this is a way that the defender of this kind of semantic account loses the basis of an objection, an important objection to the epistemic account. They can't say that what goes wrong with the epistemic account is the assertion of this existential generalisation. Okay? That there is some number n such that, blah, blah. So if that were your basic objection to epistemicism, that's fine to worry that we don't know, but you go beyond the data by then asserting that there is a number n such that, then you lose that ground of objection. Okay? You'd have to generate the objection in a slightly different way. So that's one kind of problem for supervaluationism. The second kind of problem is the one that was just mentioned. Supervaluationism, at least the version that I presented, the most kind of basic standard version, makes appeal to, in effect, a sharp three-way distinction between the definitely true, the penumbral, and the definitely false. Okay, this was a version of your concern. But it looks as though any reason we have for thinking that the heap, non-heap distinction is sorority susceptible involves this form of vagueness is just going to transmit to the distinction between something's being a definite heap and it's not being a definite heap. So we're going to get reinstatement of vagueness there. I mean, so just as we ordinarily wouldn't think that you can change something from a heap to a non-heap by adding a grain, don't think we really think that removing a single grain of sand will change something that's a definite heap into something that's not a definite heap. That would be the source of concern. And similarly going in the other direction, similarly for other cases of vagueness. So if we think that vagueness strikes at this kind of level, then we're in the market for something known as higher order vagueness. So this is, we had the initial point of vagueness between the heaps and the non-heaps. Now we have vagueness at the boundary between the definite heaps and the non-definite heaps. And we might even think it goes higher, right? If one allows that one can stack a notion of definitely, right, one might have a distinction between the definitely definite heaps and the not definitely definite heaps, which might not be definitely, not definitely heaps, so forth. So it looks to many people that we get this kind of phenomenon, we get this kind of higher order vagueness. Where you have vagueness at the base level, at least some of the time, if not all the time, you'll get vagueness recapitulated in the kind of background machinery that the supervaluationist wants to appeal to. Right, so if you have, so one response here would be to say, look, we have supervaluationism applied flat-footedly to the basic distinction between the heaps and the non-heaps, giving us this penumbral zone. Now we have a new form of vagueness between the definite heaps and the non-definite heaps. Right, so now what we need is the definite heaps and the definite not definite heaps. And that will mark two sides of our distinction, then we'll have a penumbral zone in between. So we apply our supervaluationist machinery there. Right? But then the worry will look like it'll re-emerge with respect to those boundaries. So it's possible to respond to the basic objection by appeal to supervaluationism by recapitulating the machinery at this slightly higher level. But in order for that to be ultimately successful, just based on supervaluationism, it would have to be something like the following. It would have to be so. At some finite level of reapplication of the supervaluationist machinery, one gets to a point where all vagueness vanishes. Right? Say it's at the definitely level, something like that, then there's no vagueness at that boundary. Right? The distinction between being definitely a heap and being not definitely a heap is absolutely sharp, say, right, some level. So, at this stage, without an account of higher order vagueness other than supervaluationist treatment, or some reason to think that that kind of procedure will terminate, or an argument that there's no such higher order vagueness, the basic notions of supervaluationism self appear to be susceptible to Sorati's argument. So in effect, if that's right, the account doesn't really solve the problems, it just kicks them upstairs, it pushes them up a level. Okay, so it solves the problem for heap, but it doesn't solve the problem for being a definite heap. Okay, and so forth. So that's probably the most significant concern that people have about this kind of machinery. Yeah?
Could a supervaluationist appeal to epistemic doubt about what's definitely a heap and what's not definitely a heap on that sort?
Absolutely. I mean, again, it'd be a balancing trick, because you want motivation to think that epistemicism is distinctly applicable there and not applicable at the base level. But that would be the kind of issue. So formally, you could have such a view, but it would be very delicate to provide a motivation for not being epistemicist about heap, non-heap, but being epistemicist about definitely, not definitely. It's not to say it couldn't be done. Definitely is apt to sound more epistemic than heap, right? So there could be grounds for making that kind of move. And there could be all kinds of mixed views. I mean, I was suggesting earlier that one of the worries with epistemicism is the immodest component, the position, not the ignorance component. That's fine. It's the going beyond ignorance to asserting specific sharp cutoff points. So it might be that there'd be grounds there for combining models. So perhaps being supervaluationist at some level and epistemicist at some level, combining those positions in a way, such a way as to solve these difficulties. So there might be room for that, yeah.
But also, I think it seems more plausible that, say, I don't know, perhaps 100 grains of sand is definitely a heap, and 101 grains of sand is not definitely a heap, but still probably a heap. You know, I think that's less damaging than saying, 100 grains of sand is not a heap, but 101 is.
Yeah, there might be grounds to say this. You might be worried less, for example, by someone arguing that either everything's definitely so or nothing is. I mean, that won't help the supervaluationist who needs a clear distinction. So you'd need to commit to the idea that there really are. I mean, to take the straight supervaluationist route, you need to commit to thinking there are absolutely sharp lines at some level. So perhaps, as you say, between definitely and non-definitely. It'd be no good appealing to some degree theoretic account there. One could. But again, the question would be, why do that here and not at the base level, given that you have the machinery in play anyway? There are going to be all kinds of ways of combining these views. now, we've already seen, so this is a third kind of worry. We've already seen, in effect, at least in the general way, that there's something very odd about the supervaluationist treatment of truth. Because it allows our views about bivalence to come apart from our views about the law of excluded middle. And that's apt to seem puzzling for the reasons we discussed. Same kind of difficulty seen in the way we have the truth of an existential generalisation. There is some number n where there's no specific instance of that existential generalisation. Right? There's no specific case of saying that if you've got n, then you've got a heap. If you've got n plus 1, so if you've got n, you've got no heap. If you've got n plus 1, you've got a heap. So this kind of general feeling that there's some kind of mismatch between the supervaluationist treatment of truth and the supervaluationist treatment of base-level logical principles. And that might suggest that, given that we already like law of excluded middle, if there's a problem here, it must have to do with the treatment of truth. And there's a way of pressing that kind of concern. Tim Williamson in particular has pressed the concern that at least raises a challenge for the supervaluationist. So let me just go through it. It'll appeal to kinds of principles that we're now familiar with respect to truth. So let's formalise this kind of concern in the following way. So assume the T-schema. So quotes P is true if known E of P, right? So assume that kind of banality about truth. And now assume that we have a non-true sentence. So we've got something such that it's not the case that that sentence is true, right, in accord with supervaluationist treatment. So we've got that this sentence A is not true, right, because it's in the penumbra. That's part of the supervaluationist treatment, so that's just an assumption. But now we have from the T schema that A is true if and only if A. And now given that we have that this is not true, we have that this side of the biconditional is false, so we get and we get the negation of this side of the biconditional, so we get the negation of this side, right, by biconditional. So we get that it's not A, just by application of classical logic and the ordinary understanding of the biconditional. Now, we apply the T schema to not A. So we've got not A is true if and only if not A, okay, just by the T schema. So now that we have not A from premise 3, we have this side of the biconditional, so we have that not A is true, just by another application of classical logic. Okay, so we've got that not A is true, but it seems to follow from not A's being true that A is false. Okay, just by the assumption that a sentence is false, just in case its negation is true. So it looks like if we try and combine supervaluationism with the T schema, we get an incoherence. But the T schema seems to force us to deny that you can have these kinds of truth value gaps. Okay? So if you start by trying to say that something's not true without thereby saying that it's false, the T schema forces you into the position where you end up having to say that the thing's really false, at least on natural assumptions. That's kind of predictable. I mean, it's kind of a predictable effect of trying to combine T schema, which looks bivalence friendly, with a position that tries to give up bivalence. Now, the supervaluationist accepts all the forms of reasoning that were involved in that derivation. Yeah?
Shouldn't they deny the move from 5 to 6? Because it's possible to be not true in the sense of not super true.
No, but look, this says that not A is true.
Okay.
That's the problem. So they're committed to thinking that's in effect super true. That's what leads them into the difficulty. The supervaluationist accepts all the forms of reasoning involved here because they endorse classical logic. So in order to retain their view of gaps, what they really need to do is reject the T schema. That's the thing they ought to do. And perhaps that's the version of what you're suggesting. Williamson wants to argue, and perhaps he's right, that in rejecting the T schema as governing the relevant of truth, they in effect show that their concept of supertruth isn't really a concept of truth at all. It fails to coincide with our actual notion of truth. So that would be a problem for them. So it's not that they have no way of avoiding this difficulty. They have ways of avoiding this difficulty. They just have to give an appropriate account of truth and appropriate analogues of the T schema for that notion. Williamson's concern is that what that shows is they're really failing to give an account of truth. It's a little bit like what we were talking about earlier with the idea of avoiding these difficulties by stipulating into existence a technical notion of heap, say, or a technical notion of baldness, or what have you. But what the worry here is that we're not quite doing that. We're saving something about our ordinary notion of heaps, but only by stipulating into the story a technical notion of truth. Right, that doesn't really correspond with our ordinary notion of truth. And we might worry that we're thereby failing actually to solve the problem we started with. Okay, so there's an excellent but difficult discussion of this position amongst other positions in Tim Williamson's book Vagueness, which if you want to pursue these issues, I'd certainly look at chapter 5 of that book on supervaluationism. But if you can deal with it, then it's worth reading more widely in that book. Almost certainly the best single volume on vagueness in existence, although it defends this seemingly crazy view that we're now going to turn to, epistemicism. So as well as trying to knock out every other seemingly plausible position one might take with respect to treatment of vagueness and the sororities. Williamson is the arch defender of a specific form of epistemic account of vagueness. It's really Williamson that's put this position back on the map. So I've said the epistemic account has two key components. Right? First, there are absolutely sharp cut-off points. Second, we cannot know where they are. We don't know where they are, and we can't know where they are. So the fact that we're unwilling to assert that there are cut-off, where the cut-offs are located at a particular point, isn't supposed to be explained by the non-existence of any such point. Rather, it's explained by simply by our not knowing where the cut-off point is. We're ignorant of the precise locations. And that's the basic position. So epistemicism has, like supervaluationism, has a number of attractive features, including the following. So first up, it allows us to preserve classical logic and, moreover, to preserve classical semantics. Right? Everything, the level of semantics, stays as it is. So we have absolute assertion of bivalence, law of excluded middle, and so forth. So it's a very clean account. As I've suggested, I think it's this, probably more than anything else, that makes it attractive to Williamson. And Williamson, I think, you know, this is generalising slightly, but I think Williamson in general thinks that classical logic is exactly right, and all those points where people are inclined to think that classical logic is wrong are really driven by the kind of immodesty I characterised in response to feeling of ignorance in these kinds of cases. Really, in more or less all places where classical logic looks problematic, that's because there's an epistemic difficulty we get into, and we try and deal with that epistemic difficulty by treating it as not really our fault, not really due to us, but rather due to features of the subject matter we're dealing with. So in particular, right, I said a couple of weeks ago that intuitionism is motivated philosophically, sometimes by the idea that there are claims such that we don't know and have no way of establishing the truth value of those claims. So, claims about the future, for example, like one of Dummett's favourites, a city will be built on this spot at some point in the future. Right? So, okay. We could never be in a position to establish the truth or falsity of that conjecture. Okay. Now, Williamson would say, nonetheless, that conjecture is either determinedly true or determinedly false. Right? And what we're seeing here is a problem of ignorance, the mere fact that we can't know about it. Whereas someone with Dummett's proclivities will try and argue that ultimately there are grounds for saying that in these kinds of cases, because we have no way of establishing the truth or falsity of this conjecture, it's not fixed whether it's true or false. It's not determinately true, it's not determinately false. And so we have a revision of classical logic. But Williamson doesn't like that, and would in general appeal to ignorance rather than some funky metaphysics in order to deal with these things. So it allows us to preserve classical logic and classical semantics. And yeah.
So classical logic, by that you mean law of excluded middle and law of non-contradiction?
Yeah, and bivalence.
Bivalence is just
No, bivalence in particular. Okay. But there'll be a whole other there'll be a whole bunch of other demands that are built into classical semantics. Basically, the story you learn about logic in first year classes, in effect. So if you've got something that's not true, then it's false. And so forth. Yeah.
Williamson's still alive.
Yeah. He's looking not very well in this picture.
Yeah,
he's fairly young, I guess, probably in his 50s. So young relative to me, not to you. Okay. It's also modest in that it rests with the agreed phenomenology. So the agreed starting point, in a way, is that we have this feeling of hesitancy with respect to some cases. We get ourselves in a position where we're not really willing to stick our necks out with respect to these penumbral cases. Epistemicism sticks with that rather than attempting to see it as somehow reflecting some indeterminacy in reality, some lack of a determinate fact of the matter in reality. Thus, it's also modest in not moving from this case of ignorance, indeed principled ignorance, to some specific claims in metaphysics. Right? So in those respects, it's modest. But as epistemicism, as we've already suggested, has two very large explanatory burdens, things that it needs to justify, explain, defend. So the first is it has to justify this assertion it makes that there are absolutely sharp cut-off points, despite the fact that we can't in general determine where those points are. Right, so it needs a way of justifying this claim. Second, it has to explain consistently with the story it wants to tell about how those sharp cut-off points get determined, has to explain why it is that we can't know where the sharp cut-off points are, given that those sharp cut-off points, by assumption, are determined by our meanings and our concepts. Okay? And that it looks as though those meanings thus have to have something to do with us and what we get up to with the use of our language. Now, with respect to the first assertion, right, the sharp cut-off points idea, the argument's typically indirect, right? So the argument typically goes by some combination of a foot-stamping assertion of the joys of classical logic. Okay, look, don't give up classical logic unless you absolutely have to, and my way enables you to preserve classical logic, together with an attempt to show that all extant alternative treatments, all the semantic treatments, fail. Right, so sort of one motivation would be, well, we think supervaluationism probably doesn't work out because we saw some significant objections, so that's enough to clear out supervaluationism. Now we look at other views, knock those out, and if all the views we can think of are knocked out and the only one standing is the one that asserts the existence of sharp cut-off points, that would be a kind of ground for endorsing that position. An alternative would be to provide some kind of direct argument, though this is rarely, as I said, it's rarely been attempted in any detail. I don't think Williamson goes for any kind of direct argument exactly, except insofar as he thinks that classical logic is defensible. But you might see what I said in response to supervaluationism as a kind of basis for a direct argument. Right? The concept of truth we have is governed by the T-schema. There's a very strong connection between endorsing the T-schema and endorsing bivalence. There's a very strong connection between endorsing bivalence and accepting the existence of sharp cut-off points. Thus, we have a kind of connection between our naive conception of truth by the T-schema and the acceptance of sharp cut-off points. So you could try and generate an argument of that kind, but it'll only be as strong as its weakest points, right? And people will think that cases of vagueness precisely give you grounds for weakening your adherence to either the T-schema or bivalence. Yeah.
So does anybody take the view that vague terms are really just ambiguous terms?
Yeah.
Yeah. We just haven't really
No, no, because I'm only talking about the two views. They're in, I was saying to Joseph before he left, I mean, as with the liar, right, they're indefinitely now in positions people have taken, and they probably haven't exhausted the field. I mean, there's a way in which, I think I said to you before, supervaluationism, in a sense, looks like a form of ambiguity account. It's one version of a kind of ambiguity. Exactly, or a kind of pluralist account where you have an ambiguous expression, but when you use that expression, you end up asserting all the things it could be used to say at once. Right? As if whenever I say I'll meet you at the bank, I say that I'll meet you at the riverbank and the financial institution. But yeah, so there might be views of that kind. I mean, the worries about those kinds of views is that on their most straightforward applications, they'll end up terminating in appeals to sharpenings of some kind. And then, you know, in a very general way, I didn't raise this exactly against supervaluationism, but a very general worry there will be that it's very hard to get absolute precise sharpenings. For the reasons discussed with Johnny, actually, that the way you get, where you move to sharpening, you make appeals to something in some way sharper, like grains or something, or measures of some kind. But ultimately, those measures will be susceptible at some level to a more fine-grained sort of classification underlying them, on which they supervene. It determines what goes on at the higher level that can be used to reinstate versions of vagueness. So unless reality is perfectly granular and atomic, you'll always have continua that you can exploit to drive through arguments. Yeah.
Still confused about this talk of sharpening. So tell you and you know which sharpening is meant. Is this for the same sort of word or concept? So concept like burnt sienna, say, right? Mm-hmm. Or the word whatever phrase, word noun phrase burnt sienna. Are there there are supposed to be somehow multiple sharpenings of the same word?
So they're sharpenings in the sense they're actual replacements. Mm-hmm. Right. But the idea is that they're associated with the starting expression. So say you've got the expression burnt sienna.
Yeah.
That will cover on this kind of view a vaguely delimited region of say wavelength or reflectance properties or something, right, in physics. Whether you want to identify the colour with those reflectance properties, there'll be some kind of determination relation between them. Okay. So at that level, you reinstate sororities by saying, you know, changing the wavelength by this quantity won't take you from something that's burnt sienna to something that isn't. Right, so you get a tolerance. The sharpening idea would be the idea that at that level that you're driving through the argument, the level of determinate values for some reflectance property or wavelength, one can stipulate a notion burnt sienna wavelength X, burnt sienna wavelength Y, and so forth. Each of those will be a sharpening in the sense that it will somewhat fit the ordinary use of the expression, but it will get rid of the source of the vagueness that led to the sororities paradox. Does that
help? Bit? Sort of. I mean, do you have any sort of, I guess Williamson would probably, who's the person to read on the passage? Because I know Kate Klein is the guy that sort of came up with it.
I don't know anyone who's really gone to town in trying to explain why these things count as sharpenings.
Because, doesn't it originate as a sort of technical account of trying to explain Vegas, and now we're trying to understand it in everyday language, isn't it?
No, I mean, it is a technical account, but if it's going to be an account of vagueness, then it has to be applied natural language.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, if we weren't attempting that, then we just should stick with the sharpenings, right? So if all we wanted was some system of characterising reality that wasn't sorority susceptible, drop talk of heaps altogether and just move down to the level where the sharpenings function. As I said, there are going to be issues there because it's non-trivial that there is a level such that the sharpenings at that level aren't sorority susceptible. That would be the difficult, a significant difficulty. I think Williamson discusses some form of ambiguity account, but I can't remember the details. He discusses a range of views, that broad sort. Okay, so. So the idea, so we've got the idea there are these absolute sharp boundaries. Now we want to explain why we're ignorant of those boundaries. And the idea here, very roughly, is first that knowledge is subject to certain kinds of limits determined by our powers of discrimination, very, very roughly. So this is driven by a principle, some version of a principle that Williamson takes to govern knowledge, which is a kind of safety principle. It's akin to the kinds of things, you might have come across this in epistemology, is akin to the kinds of things governing Nozick's account of knowledge, right? If you remember that from the first year, if you did it then. Right? Nozick has a kind of sensitivity idea where if you know something, then if it weren't so, you'd realise it wasn't so, and in nearby worlds where it is so, you continue to think it's so, that kind of thing. So you're kind of sensitive. Things are. Safety conditions are, in a way, a better version of Nozick's account. And the idea here is that if you know something, then you're so placed with respect to the thing you know that there isn't too much danger that you're getting things wrong. Right? So there's some way you came to know this thing, and deploying that way in nearby worlds, nearby circumstances, wouldn't lead you astray, or in too many cases. Right? So either the cases where you'd go wrong, say brain in a vat cases, are massively distant from the actual from reality. There's very little danger, given how things are, that I'm in a brain in a vat, that I end up being in a brain in a vat. Okay, so there's no danger of that. So either the cases where I go wrong are very far away in modal space, they're not near possibilities, like my spilling my coffee is a near possibility, or they can be relatively close, but still there's little danger of me going wrong because I'm sensitive to the difference between the cases, right? So again, there's little danger of my going wrong. So the idea is that when you know something, you're in that kind of position. There isn't too much danger of you going wrong, yeah.
This is something I wondered before, actually. Do you know anywhere where somebody sketches out what this kind of modal distance concept actually means?
Yeah, David Lewis would be a place to start. Now, I can't remember an exact reference, but send me an email. There will be a discussion in the plurality of worlds, but there's discussion earlier than that in specific papers,
right.
Probably in one of the papers on counterfactuals. He'll say something about, but he'll various refinements needed of what he ends up saying. But for our purposes, it's just an intuitive idea; it needn't be characterised too finely. So the idea is that when you know something, there has to be little danger of you forming beliefs in the same sort of way and thereby forming false beliefs. So again, either if things changed, you're suitably sensitive that you'd recognise they've changed and you wouldn't form the false belief. Or there are these circumstances where sensitivity would fail because you're a brain in a vat or whatever, but they're so distant from actuality that, again, there's little danger of your being in that position. Now, the idea is that if it were also the case that determining the precise boundaries of the application of a concept or predicate would outstrip our discriminatory abilities, the idea is that there'd be too much danger of our going wrong. So I take a stand and say, I don't know, a heap is 101 grains or something, right? Even if I'm right about that, there's significant danger for some reason that I could be wrong. Right? I can't tell whether I'm in a situation where that's right as opposed to nearby situations where that's wrong. So for that reason, I can't know. And now, in order to explain the need for very fine discrimination, Williamson appeals to the idea that very small changes in the use of expressions made either by me or by us as a group might make for shifts in their boundaries. So in order to keep track of where the precise boundaries are, I'd have to keep track of what everyone's up to in their uses in a way that was sufficiently sensitive to very fine changes in that activity. So since we wouldn't ordinarily be able to tell when such shifts had occurred or the precise ways in which those shifts would bear on the precise boundaries fixed, we're ignorant of the boundaries. I'm going to stop in 2 seconds, 10 seconds. So let me just say one thing about this in response to this view. So I think the view is very clever. It's very beautiful. It has lots of lovely properties. One puzzle that strikes me as significant about this view that goes beyond the generic worry about how we can be ignorant of the extensions of our own expressions is that suppose we could explain in the kind of way that Williamson appeals to, why we're in fact ignorant of these boundaries. So why is that I don't count as knowing what those boundaries are? it looks as though that won't explain the phenomenology unless I'm also somehow sensitive to my ignorance. Right? Because look, there are plenty of cases where I'm both ignorant of some fact, but also confident that I know the fact. In those cases, I'll simply assert the fact. I'm like this with directions. Right? If you ask me directions almost anywhere, I will, as far as is in my power, simply assert some claims about how to get where you want to go. Okay, it's just a foible of mine. But I'll be wrong. But I'll feel that I'm confident about this. I feel as though I know during in the period where I'm telling you. Right? Now, suppose one were in that position with respect to sharp boundaries. Right? So I think I know exactly where the boundary is between the heaps and the non-heaps. So you give me some penumbral cases and I just sort them like this. I'm completely confident. Say, that's definitely a heap, definitely a heap, definitely a heap, definitely. Oh, 100 grains, that's definitely not a heap, definitely not a heap, like this. Okay, that looks like it should, that picture looks like it should be consistent with my nonetheless being entirely ignorant about where the borderline is. Even if, perchance, I get the distinction exactly right, right, in a way that's unknowable to any of us. So the difficulty I just wanted to point to is that it's not quite clear how simple appeal to or in fact not knowing could explain what needs to be explained, which is the phenomenology of hesitancy, lack of confidence in the application of our terms. In general, there might be some correlation between ignorance and lack of confidence, but it's imperfect in various ways. And it looks like that's a matter of principle. Right? We don't always know whether or not we know something. And very often we're mistaken. So that was what I wanted to end with. Thank you very much for your patience, and thanks for your help this term.